I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM, LP, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the show, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, which, as you know, is one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And we do have a website for the program, which you can access at radioinvivo.net. You can get to all of our past programs on the website. And we are approaching 60 hours of programming there. So there's something for just about everybody, and we invite you to check it out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and you'll get right to the podcast site. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well at communityradio.coop. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. And Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and it is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but not least, as we're thanking the people that make this possible, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and you can also visit its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. Well, this week on Radio In Vivo, we are going to be taking on one of the biggest questions of all. How did our universe start, and when will it end? These are questions we all think and wonder about, of course, from time to time. But, of course, there are professionals who spend all of their time pondering questions like these. And my guest today is one such academic, and he recently shook up the field of cosmology with the publication, along with a colleague, of his astonishing new theory about the origin and ultimate fate of the universe. Paul Frampton is the Rubin Professor of Physics in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at UNC Chapel Hill. He's the author of more than 350 scientific articles and several books, and his research focuses on model building in cosmology and high energy physics. Paul received his undergraduate and graduate degrees at the University of Oxford and has been at UNC since 1981. Paul, thank you for taking the time on this Independence Day to come in and join us on Radio In Vivo.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
To get us started, Paul, in the simplest possible terms for those of us who are not professionally conversant with the field of cosmology, just please describe this new model that you published earlier this year, and then I'd kind of like to backtrack and define some of the terminology you're using and discuss some of the ideas in more detail.
Okay, well, cosmology is the science of the study of the entire universe in the large. That is, at scales bigger than the scale of single galaxies or even clusters of galaxies, looking at the expansion of the entire universe and using mainly Einstein's theory of general relativity. And it's a field that goes back to 1917, when actually Einstein himself wrote the first paper applying his theory to the entire universe. To talk about this new paper, it may be useful just to say briefly the history of, especially of the Big Bang concept. It
sure.
was it was realized in the 1920s when people wrote down the equations describing the universe, making basic assumptions like that it was uniform and rotationally invariant. There's a basic equation called the Friedmann equation, which describes the expansion of the universe, sometimes called the Friedmann-Lemaître equation, which was written down in the 1920s. And it was realized even then, since the universe had been discovered to be expanding in the late 20s, that if you extrapolated back in time, we now know the amount of time is 13.7 billion years, relatively exactly.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, the equations break down, and what we now call the Big Bang occurs. Then it was called an initial singularity. Actually, the name Big Bang was invented as a derogatory term by an opposing theory in the 1950s called the steady-state model.
Is that right?
But the Big Bang actually is...
Because it's certainly part of common parlance.
Yes.
It caught on. Like
and so it's always been known since then that there is a problem with the equations if you go all the way back to the Big Bang. But people, even at that time, tried to avoid the Big Bang by making what was called a cyclic universe. That is, the universe would expand, turn around at some point, recontract, and then bounce before it reached the Big Bang. And the whole point of doing that was to avoid this problem with the singularity.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, everyone, there was an obstacle to doing this. There were very leading theorists at the time, particularly a man called Tolman, who worked all through his career. And the problem was a problem with the concept of entropy, or the degree of disorder of the universe. Mm-hmm. And
the as I read the materials, the problem there was the fact that there wasn't enough entropy at the supposed beginning of the universe.
That's right. The entropy at the beginning is unexpectedly low. And also, there's a statistical law which dictates that entropy always increases. It's called the second law of thermodynamics,
sure.
technically,
mm-hmm.
which is a very important law, which was discovered in the 19th century. Now, the problem with making a cyclic universe, which was found, was that because the entropy has to increase, the cycles in the universe got bigger and longer, rather than all being the same, and that meant going back in time, they would get smaller and shorter, and so it would inevitably lead back to a Big Bang,
mm-hmm.
the avoidance of which was the motivation for doing...
The point of the whole enterprise.
The point of the whole enterprise. Now, that situation lasted really until the 21st century, like 70 years. Nobody really knew... Everyone was familiar with that problem, but nobody really knew what to do. Okay, now enter a new... cosmology has undergone enormous progress in the last 10 years or less. It's really gone forward through leaps and bounds, and we now know more, far more about the universe than we did just 10 years ago. It's the fastest moving area in theoretical physics, comparing to the state of particle theory, which we can maybe come back to.
Sure.
But the so one very important discovery was made first around 1998, just less than 10 years ago. It was unexpectedly discovered that the expansion of the universe, instead of slowing down, the expansion rate slowing down is actually accelerating.
Right. And that's that, counterintuitive to the concept of a Big Bang, where you would assume that something blows up and eventually loses its energy, right?
Exactly right. Yeah, that's what I think practically everyone expected before the observations made in 1998,
mm-hmm.
that the expansion rate was slowing down. There were questions whether it would slow down and come to a stop or whether it would continue expanding forever. But nobody expected this result, that the expansion rate is actually increasing. So you have an accelerated expansion. Now, this was discovered initially by observations of very distant, very bright objects called supernovae.
Mm-hmm.
It's been confirmed by independent observations, especially of the cosmic microwave background, and very, very detailed other observations of distant objects. And so this means when we feed this into this expansion rate equation called the Friedman equation, that there is a new driving term, unexpected, which is now called the dark energy. So there's this new component of energy in the universe called dark energy, and it is actually at least 70% of the total.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is the new ingredient which is used in this model we made published earlier this year with a student called Loris Bohm and I. And so the dark energy means that discussing the future of the universe, the dark energy is now already 70%, and if one extrapolates into the future, it very rapidly becomes 99%, 99.999%. It takes over the universe and dictates the future fate of the universe, how it expands in the future.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, dark energy is not matter as we know it. Is that correct?
No, it is not. I should have said that the other 30% is matter, of which only on the order of 1% is luminous matter.
Mm-hmm.
About a total of perhaps 5% is made of ordinary matter, some of which we can't see, and 25% is what's called dark matter or non-baryonic dark matter. It's dark matter which not only can we not see, but it is made up of we do not know what.
Right.
You know, so 95% of the universe we don't understand. That's the non-baryonic dark matter, and then there is the dark energy.
Okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is in a way exciting, but humbling.
So there's a lot left to learn.
There's a lot left for young researchers to find out in the 21st century. Yeah, we're at the and this dark energy issue is, some of us think, is probably the deepest question in all of theoretical physics and astronomy. It's been compared to the ether of the beginning of the 20th century, where there was this hypothesized medium which turned out not to exist. But it's a little bit reminiscent of that. And that's exciting because to resolve that led to relativity and ultimately quantum mechanics. So perhaps there are things that are in the near future which will be equally revolutionary, and they may stem perhaps from understanding dark energy. Anyway, coming back to the future of the universe, the details depend on technical assumptions about the dark energy. In particular, it has the most peculiar property of it is that it has a negative pressure, which is somehow counterintuitive. And the ratio of that pressure to the density is technically called the equation of state. And we don't know exactly what that is. But if the pressure is sufficiently negative, what it means is that the universe will accelerate faster than exponentially, and will blow itself apart at a finite time in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Finite time means hundreds of billions of years, perhaps as long as a trillion years. It's not something that we have to worry about.
Right.
but it nevertheless...
You don't have to pay up our life insurance.
No, it's not. So in one version of it, the dark energy leads to an end. This is different from previous scenarios where the universe would typically, if it was what's called an open or flat universe, it would expand forever. So the time in the future was previously generally thought to be infinite. Mm-hmm. And in the past, it was thought to be 13.6 billion years. That is still, in a way, the standard cosmology,
right,
which is being questioned by current research. So this scenario with the especially negative pressure leads to an end of the universe, a finite time in the future, and that's got the name Big Rip. It's mm-hmm. called a Big mm-hmm. Rip. So you, in that scenario, you start with a Big Bang, a finite time in the past, and you end in the future with a Big Rip, a finite time, a longer time, a finite time in the future. That precedes our model. Now, in our model, we make a further assumption of terms in this, again, this Friedmann-Lemaître equation, inspired partly by derivations that have been made using string theory, higher dimensional theories, although we think it can be derived directly in without those assumptions, which leads to a universe where it approaches this Big Rip,
mm-hmm.
but a very, very short time, less than a trillion trillionth of a second before this turnaround, before this Big Rip, the universe turns around and starts contracting. And this is a way, as it turns out, of solving this entropy issue, because it turns out that at that turnaround, the universe becomes causally disconnected into a huge number of what are called patches or causal patches, each of which will contract separately into a universe, and the other one of them would be, let's say, our universe.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Now, it turns out because it is divided into so many patches, the entropy of one patch is zero, basically. In fact, it turns out to be identically zero. So the universe then contracts with zero entropy, with constant zero entropy, and then by the same new term, it will bounce before it reaches this Big Bang, and the entropy will again be injected, increase due to expansion.
And we find ourselves right back where we started.
And then we go back.
That's
the cyclic universe mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. the dark energy has made possible. And the main two ingredients are this idea of turning around just before the Big Rip, using this dark energy with a slightly more negative pressure, and perhaps most important, the idea that the universe comes back completely empty of any matter of any kind, black holes, particles, anything. It just contains dark energy, and that seems to make it work as far as we can see. I should say there are still some technical calculations that have to be done to make sure
I'm sure.
Which we are doing, yeah.
I imagine so.
But that was the original paper, yeah.
So, at this turnaround, not only our universe, as you characterized it, but as you said, a large number of other universes are generated at the same time.
That's right.
Is that an infinite number, or is that a finite?
Okay, that's a very good question. Okay, we have studied this question. So the number of universes which are spawned at each turnaround is a very large but finite number.
Okay.
Now, if one asks about, again, going into the past, the idea of a cyclic universe is that it has an infinite past. And if the present number of universes were finite, inevitably, if you go back some number, some finite number of cycles, it will get back to one or zero.
Mm-hmm. And we're right back to the Big Bang.
And you're right back to the Big Bang, exactly. So it turns...
Just when we thought we had that figured out.
Yeah. The infinite past is a little more subtle than the infinite future. The infinite past, it turns out that it must be the case that the present number of universes is infinite. And for any arbitrarily long time in the past, it must be infinite. And in fact, there are mathematical ways of characterizing that, which we have done. There's in something called set theory. And so it turns out when it's infinite and it's multiplied by a finite number, it remains the same number, which is infinite. Technically, mm-hmm. It's called Aleph zero. But okay. So the number of, in this model, the number of universes forever in the future and for an arbitrarily long time in the past is infinite. It's an infiniverse,
okay.
I feel like, as
okay.
opposed to a multiverse. It turns out that the limit of the infinite past is still relatively undefined, but all that one can say is that for an arbitrarily long time in the past, this number is infinite. And that's where we've left it at the moment.
I see.
Taking that limit is a little bit subtle or ambiguous.
I can imagine. Must keep the computers crunching. So this, Paul, this really is all borne out ultimately by the mathematics involved, is it not? Where are we in terms of any kind of observational confirmation of this or any of the other theories that are floating
around?
Oh,
okay. Well, you might easily think that this can't, you know, since it involves hundreds of billions of years in the future or billions of years in the past, it could not be easily tested. But actually, there is a way of getting some insight or some possible supporting evidence for it. And that comes because, as I mentioned, the whole model depends on this, how negative the pressure of the dark energy is. And it depends on this ratio of the pressure, which is negative, divided by the density of the dark energy. Now, we know observationally already from precision measurements that this number is fairly close to minus one, mm-hmm. so that the mm-hmm. pressure in magnitude is equal to the density. But the limits on it are roughly minus one with an error of 0.1 or something like that. The value minus one is a special value which corresponds to what's called a cosmological constant, which is something introduced by Einstein in 1917 for completely different reasons.
Sure.
But maybe comes back in that may be what the dark energy will turn out to be. But for this model to work with the Big Rip or the turnaround just before the Big Rip, W must be less than minus one, and it can be arbitrarily close, but it must be less than minus one. I should say there's another cyclic model which was invented around 2002 by two cosmologists called Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok. Paul Steinhardt's at Princeton, Neil Turok's at Cambridge in England.
Mm-hmm.
And their model requires W never to be less than minus one. So there's a distinction.
Sure.
Now, it turns out that the accuracy of that measurement of the equation of state will be made more precise by a satellite called the Planck Surveyor, which is going to be launched by the European Space Agency. It was supposed to go up around now, but now it's scheduled for the fall of 2008. And it will measure this W to, I think, something like 0.01. So if it finds, it all depends, we don't know what W is, but if it is distinctly less than minus one, that would support this model. it may end up being consistent with minus one, so we won't know.
Right.
Or on the other hand, if it turned out to be more positive, you know, bigger, more positive than minus one, that would be certainly kill the model we proposed, I think. So it is something that will be tested in the relatively near future.
Yeah. Sure. Well, that's fascinating that a satellite can give you that kind of potentially confirmation or refutation.
Yeah, it's well, it keeps us going. I mean, it's nice. That's, by the way, been a problem in particle theory. We've been waiting for years for data. So in cosmology, the great thing about cosmology of the last 10 years is that the amount of data coming in is very... very high quality, very accurate, and a lot of it. And mm-hmm. so that's how we've learned so much.
What has fueled that trend in the last 10 years?
Technology, I believe. Things, you know, the satellite, the possibility of sending up satellites which are above the Earth's atmosphere, the possibility of studying... these very distant objects like the supernovae, the especially the WMAP, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, which was sent up in 2003, I believe, and has taken incredibly accurate data of the microwave background, which originated about 400,000 years after the Big Bang, if there was one.
Right.
And so I think technology has led to this far more accurate data. And so...
Mm-hmm. Has the Hubble been a big contribution?
Oh, the Hubble Space Telescope, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Has had a fantastic career, so to speak. I mean,
sure.
It has led to not only these beautiful pictures that everybody's seen, but an incredible amount of information. Which is, for example, the supernovae. The way the supernovae are found, we don't know where they're going to go off. They're often initially seen, so to speak, with wide-angle Earth-based telescopes, and then it's communicated to, say, to the Hubble telescope, which can point in the right direction and get a much better measurement. So the Hubble has been involved in all of that, and it's had an enormous positive effect on cosmology, yeah, for sure.
I see. My guest on Radio In Vivo this morning is Dr. Paul Frampton from the UNC Department of Physics and Astronomy. Paul, I want to come back to your theory. First of all, we need to give it a sexy name like Big Bang or Big Crunch or Big Rip. We need to do a little PR for it.
Okay.
But the question I have, this cyclic cosmology, this model, what does it do to the concept of time?
Well, that's very interesting because the time in the Big Bang theory, the presumption is that this time ago, say 13.7 billion years ago, time began. Now, and in the standard cosmology, the expansion may go on forever, so time will never end. So this is one possibility. In the Big Rip, we have the time beginning at the Big Bang and ending at the Big Rip. The cyclic cosmology reveals the possibility, which is uncomfortable to some people, that time never began. And time will never end either. That time has been...
Does that almost lead to there really is no such thing?
No such thing as time?
Yeah.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean,
okay.
Our program is 1 hour long.
Right,
so
we have some evidence.
Some evidence. I think that time is a very... difficult concept. I mean, what relativity did, what Einstein did in special relativity was to relate space and time, and that gave mm-hmm. us a completely new idea about time.
Sure.
And in general relativity, it's in a way almost more mixed up. The curvature of, we talk about the curvature of space-time. But in, as I said before, in the 20s and 30s, it did seem that time began at the Big Bang. What sort of surprised us earlier this year is that the idea that there isn't a Big Bang seems to have a lot of interest in the general public. The fact that the time may never have begun. This seems to be something on which a lot of non-scientists have opinions. A lot of them are much more comfortable if time begins. They say it obviously began, and comparable or perhaps more people are think that it's better that it never began. But it leads into, if you like, religious and philosophical questions.
Sure, absolutely.
And so it does give a new way of thinking about time. Yes.
Well, and I think that the Big Bang has entered the popular consciousness as as conventional wisdom, as people take it almost as a given.
That's right.
These days.
Yes. 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 And it's still. It's still. The conventional wisdom is perhaps changing as we speak, but the most standard cosmology, it still has the Big Bang. And I should say what many scientists say is that if you go back in time just before you reach the Big Bang, there might be some effect of quantum mechanics or quantum gravity which will avoid the problem of the singularity. What we do isn't depending on quantum mechanics. It's really a classical picture. So we don't appeal to quantum mechanics to resolve it. So that's a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And the... But I think these questions, did time begin and will time end, are fascinating questions, which are now being studied in a scientific way.
So is there any way to bring observational data in to those kind of questions, as with, you know, the satellite's going to take a look at the dark energy and hopefully give you an answer?
Well, that's the main... connection with observation at the moment. If that turns out to work, that W is this equation of state is less than minus one, that would be obviously very important. It wouldn't necessarily confirm this specific model, but
sure,
it would strongly suggest that the one should seriously think of alternatives to the Big Bang.
And so
I think that view of cosmology would...
Because at that point, the Big Bang just no longer works, right?
That's right, yes. And both the past and the future of the universe have to be reconsidered. You know? So that aspect of cosmology might change. It still looks as though the universe is expanding, as if it still looks as though it came from a Big Bang this time ago. But in this picture, that only works going back to, say, a trillionth of a second after what would have been the Big Bang. Then something different happens. Yeah. So it's not that the whole universe looks different. It looks like it does now, obviously.
Right.
But it changes the origin. So I think it's interesting.
Absolutely. Well, you talk about the turnaround when this fragmentation would happen, and the generation of this large but finite number of universes.
Yes.
And they would all be contracting. One of the things I found fascinating reading about all this and trying from my lay perspective to get a handle on it was that as that moment approaches, the what's left of the universe at that point actually starts traveling faster than the speed of light. Am I correct on that?
Well, yes and no. No particles actually travel faster than the speed of light, but the boundary of the universe expands faster than the speed of light, and that is actually in part what leads to this causality problem, that things pull apart so fast that they can no longer communicate at the speed of light. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, there is an expansion of the space-time manifold faster than the speed of light. But no actual particles move, or in fact information move faster than the speed of light. So
We're not breaking Einstein's laws.
Oh, no, good heavens, no. All of this...
we wouldn't think about that.
Well, people... people... people are considering variations of Einstein's general relativity as well, and perhaps trying to get rid of this dark energy. That's a different approach, but that's not what we're doing. I mean, I have actually worked on that, but this particular model is adhering to Einstein's general relativity. There isn't any reason to doubt. Although Einstein's general relativity has really only been tested accurately in systems that are comparable to the size of our solar system. It has never really been confirmed on the scale of the universe. So it's perfectly reasonable to query that, but the simplest assumption, the more conservative thing, is to assume that it works at all scales.
I see.
But then the other thing is being studied. Seriously,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you say look at that at all scales, and that brings us to a question I had is that this model you have been espousing, does it only work at the macro scale, or do these ideas in any way also inform thinking in particle physics? Is there any correlation between the two? And I know you want to talk about the latest what's going on in particle physics anyway.
Well, that's a very good question. Actually, these considerations of dark energy seem to be related only to the cosmological observations. I don't, as far as we know, there isn't any direct connection to the smallest things that I also study, these things that are, say, smaller than protons and particle theory.
Mm-hmm.
I could talk a bit about particle theory if you like.
Yes, let's do it.
Well,
there's a lot of exciting things going on.
There's a lot of exciting things going on. Unfortunately, the data is not yet coming in like it is in cosmology, but it will starting in 2008. There is a very important machine called the Large Hadron Collider, or LHC, which is almost completing construction at CERN in Switzerland, near Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
And it is now expected to start running in May 2008 at an energy seven times that of the next biggest accelerator, which is running near Chicago. And so this is very exciting because it means that we hope various questions. There is a very successful model in particle theory called the Standard Model, which was invented in the 1960s by people like Glashow, Salam, and Weinberg, and it has been confirmed and reconfirmed for decades.
Right.
But, and all the various constituents, the six types of quark and six types of lepton, have been discovered. But the one particle which hasn't been discovered yet is called the Higgs boson. And we expect it to be between about 100 and 200 times the mass of a proton, which is exactly the region that the LHC will be able to look at. So one thing...
So if it's there, it will find it.
If it's there...
We hope.
They should find it. If it isn't there, it will be even more interesting because it will...
Well, what would either conclusion tell us?
Well, if it's there, it would confirm the simplest version of the Standard Model, and its properties can be studied, and it will lead to a better understanding of the masses of the various quarks and leptons and so on. If it isn't there, it would be even more puzzling because it would seem that things like quantum mechanics and conservation of probability and so on say that it has to be there. So
it is predicted.
It is predicted definitively to be there. And if it isn't, it would be...
Higgs will be very disappointed, if nothing else.
Well, Higgs is a friend of mine. He's a retired professor in Edinburgh in Scotland, uh-huh. Peter Higgs. And
how exciting to have the elemental particle named after you.
Well, that's right. He's a very modest chap. I think he was once asked if he thought it was worth $10 billion to find out if his particle existed. And his reply was something like, yeah, I'm curious to know, but I don't think it's worth $10 billion. Well, but the rest of the world obviously does.
And, indeed.
I hope it's found. And in particle theory, the other thing which is relatively new, actually starting also from 1998, is neutrino masses. Neutrinos were thought to be perhaps massless, but now there are all sorts of experiments starting in 98 which have measured the oscillations of neutrinos and their mixing angles and all that sort of thing. And that is a very exciting aspect of particle theory. And one of the other things I'm working on is to try to go beyond the standard model to put in extra symmetries which will accommodate these mixing angles of neutrinos, and which has been done actually by others, and to extend that to include quarks and to try to get some idea of where the quark masses, which have a huge hierarchy of masses,
mm-hmm.
and the top quark in particular is extremely heavy compared to the others, and we can to some extent explain that. And the other five quarks have a sort of hierarchy of masses which we can begin to explain, but the actual quantitative values of those masses probably needs a new idea. That's we've been trying to get some ideas, but the numbers for these masses seem to be mysterious still, and have been for a long time.
Now, is that the kind of thing that something like the super collider can detect and measure?
Absolutely, yeah. The LHC, the supercollider, is the one that didn't.
That's the one that didn't make
didn't
it.
Make it,
because I did want to ask you about that.
Oh, okay.
Well.
Yeah, the LHC, yes, absolutely. So when the Higgs boson is discovered and its couplings to quarks and leptons are measured accurately, probably this will lead to a much better understanding of these numbers, which are the masses. That's a reasonable hope. So this data will be crucial.
So this will potentially be a real breakthrough of our understanding of the nature of particles.
Yeah, it probably, it's quite probable that particle theory will at that point take off and perhaps become as popular or more popular than cosmology is now. The theory is always driven by good data coming from experiments and observations. Yeah.
Now, it's interesting that you actually work in both scales.
Yes, it's really fascinating. I started off in my career working on the smallest scales, the particle theory. It's only in the last 10 years or so that I've focused more on cosmology. But what's really fascinating is that these two fields are related.
Mm-hmm. Are they converging?
Yes. I mean, the point is that you might say, why is something 10 to the minus 15 meters or smaller related to the universe, which is 10 to the plus some huge number of meters? The answer is, in the early universe, it all comes together, because as you go back to what would be the Big Bang, temperature gets higher, the energy gets higher, and the physics of the very small distances comes into play. So the particle theory and the cosmology are closely related in the first second, or actually fraction of a second, of the universe. And it's absolutely fascinating that the model building in high energy physics and cosmology are overlapping. You need to do both somehow. So the very, very smallest and the very, very largest are related, and all the scales in between are, in a sense, like our size, mm-hmm. are less related. We are very complex systems.
Well, that's kind of the ultimate goal, is it not? The correct me if I'm wrong in my terminology, the grand unified theory, the theory of everything?
Yeah, that's right, to unify the forces of gravity with the other forces, and that will impact on cosmology for sure, and perhaps in particle theory. I mean, some people think that I'm not one of them really, but the gravity might play a role in the LHC data from next year, if it has certain properties like large extra dimensions and things like that. Mm-hmm. This is, I think, a bit of a long shot, but anything is possible. You know, that's what some people propose, to look for large extra dimensions, to look for evidence of string theory, which is this elusive theory which hundreds of people are working on.
Right, right.
And at this point of time, nobody quite knows exactly what to do with string theory, at least in terms of making a prediction that can be tested. I mean,
right, of course. My guest on Radio In Vivo this morning is Dr. Paul Frampton from the UNC Department of Physics and Astronomy. Paul, I'd like to get back to your theory of cyclic cosmology.
Oh, okay.
Just a little bit. Yeah, you've mentioned to me a couple of times now that you've been kind of floored by the amount of reaction you've gotten, and I would assume that applies to both the general public and to professional circles. Could you tell us about that a little bit?
Well, unfortunately, so far, it's, in a sense, unfortunately, it's more in the general public than in scientific circles. I mean, the paper has been cited, I think, about 10 times, and people are interested in it and have commented on it. It's a little bit different. It takes a while for the scientific community to sort of embrace it or incorporate it.
Mm-hmm. And you published in February.
Right? Yeah, yes. The paper was published in February 2007. The public reaction was surprising, that the journal encouraged the author of a published paper to make a news release, which was made by Becky Oskin, whom you know from UNC.
Right.
And that went out, and there were a very nice little, 500-page piece about it, and it includes statements like there is no Big Bang and things of that sort. That was picked up, I think, in the New Scientist in England almost immediately. But then in the month of February particularly, it spread like wildfire on the webs and the blogs.
And suddenly you were a rock star.
Well, it had, and my student, yeah, it was astonishing that names were transliterated into a dozen languages, and there were blogs running in Asia and Europe and South America and so on. And I think it just shows that the general public is very interested in the idea of time and the Big Bang and that sort of thing. Possibly,
well, as you mentioned, these are basic questions that, you know, are not only scientific questions but do delve into the realms of philosophy and religion.
Yeah, and that's everything. Yeah, so it's something that gets a more immediate response than, say, discussing the Higgs boson or something like that, which is a rather technical idea. Yeah.
Sure, although Dr. Higgs, I'm sure, would probably
right,
disagree
right.
with
yes,
you. But
yes.
Paul, where did this idea come from? Was this developed over a long period of time and labor, or did you have one of those proverbial eureka moments?
Oh, this turn to this cyclic cosmology. Well, actually, I started talking to this new student, Loris Bohm, I think in the spring or summer of 2006, and I had been sort of latently interested in cyclic cosmology because I'd read about it when I was a student in Oxford about 40 years ago. And in fact, this chap Tolman wrote a magnificent book on thermodynamics and cosmology in 1934, I think, and he had set up this conundrum of the entropy, and I had studied it in my around 1965 when I was studying for a final exam in Oxford, and I'd been fascinated. It wasn't on the exam, but I remembered being and that sort of was in the back of my mind somehow, in sort of long-term memory. And this student came, and he did go away and read papers, and he came back as a good student should and asked all sorts of questions, you know, how does this work? And he was reading Steinhardt and Turok's papers, for example.
Uh-huh.
And in talking to him and, you know, explaining as far as I could studying these papers also. The idea sort of came from those discussions, and I think I thought of it, the idea of the universe coming back empty, I think, was a new idea, came in around October 2006. That was a slightly epiphanous moment, but I had been thinking about the whole thing for decades, you know, and it is a sure. well-known problem. Whether we have the right solution is, you know, time will tell.
Of course, and of course you have to maintain that kind of scientific objectivity, but do you think it's right?
Yes, I'm always in this business. I think one has to be what I call ridiculously optimistic. One has to be optimistic about one's own work, because if one isn't oneself, I don't think anybody else will be. So,
right.
Yeah, I think it has a chance, and I don't know any fatal flaw. So it could be correct and revolutionary, or it could go into the trash can of history like most papers do. You know, it just remains for other people and us to check the consistency and to await what the Planck surveyor finds and that sort of thing.
Right. So you will have a pretty good answer before long.
I hope so. Yeah. If the satellite goes up and
right.
I hope it will. Yeah.
Paul, I'm sure that our listeners would be very interested to hear a little bit more about your own background. Could you sketch that out for us a little bit?
My background? Oh.
Yes.
Well, I'm born in England, in a small town, and was good at taking exams and got into Oxford and got a good degree, a first-class degree, stayed in Oxford and got a doctorate. And then I, in 1968, then I came to America, to Chicago, and then I went to CERN as a fellow for 2 years. Then I expected to go back to England as a permanent job, perhaps in Oxford or Cambridge or London, but I wasn't offered a job in London, I remember. And so I came back to America, and I've postdoced around and ended up in Chapel Hill, 1981. And but maybe I should say something about the department.
Please do.
Department
yeah,
of Physics and Astronomy has people working in theory, like myself. We have the first time ever we have a female department chair, Laurie McNeil, one of whose aims is to increase the female component. And we have now, we just hired a new observational astronomer, Sheila Canapan, who's coming on board. We just reappointed an assistant professor in cosmology, Laura Massini. We have Laurie herself. We have another, Louise Dolan, who's a full professor in string theory. So we actually have 4 now out of 30, which doesn't sound very much. It should be 50%, but at least it's sure. a project that cannot fail. Nobody yeah. fully understands why the fraction of female physics professors is so much less than 50%. You may remember the president of Harvard
yes.
made a hasty comment that it was genetic, and he lost his job.
Lost his job.
So I don't
exactly.
want to get into that. But right.
Historically, that has been
yes.
the case. That it's
yes.
been a male-dominated field.
Yes, and despite the fact that for the last 30 years or more, there's been an active effort by universities to get female candidates to apply, and mm-hmm. you know, it's puzzling after 30 years that it's still 4 out of 30 is quite good, actually, believe
yeah.
it or not. In the department, so there are other theorists: Jack Ng, Charles Evans, John Engel, J.P. Liu, Dmitry Vischenko, in addition to the ones. But the other areas are condensed matter. The biggest area is condensed matter physics with experiment. That's in materials. Is now we have an assistant professor, Paul Tiesinger, and we're going to hire a couple of more biophysicists. It seems to be a tendency for physics to go into biophysics
sure.
And study neuroscience and that sort of thing. And another big group is astronomy, that I, where there are a lot of observational astronomers. It's, you may have heard of the SOAR telescope, which is built in Chile. They're using the SALT telescope in South Africa. And an assistant professor, Dan Reichardt, has something called PROMPT, which is some array of telescopes by which he looks for gamma ray bursts. And he's, I think, found the oldest one in the universe. So there's a lot going on, and the ranking, it's ranked around number 30 in the country. Chemistry is ranked around number 15. So we would hope to get to similar ranking in physics. So hopefully that will happen.
Yeah, I'm sure it will.
Anyway, there's a lot going on.
How does
on.
The does the do you folks work at the planetarium? Is there a tie-in with the department?
Yeah, the astronomers certainly make use of that. They have a very popular program of school children and public coming to look at the planetarium, and they can look through this 24-inch. There's a big 24-inch telescope on the top, which is used, I believe, sometimes. But for serious research, I think the seeing isn't too good in Chapel Hill.
Yeah,
it's better to go to a darker place.
Sure. Well, Paula, last but not least, as we're actually almost out of time for today already, would be remiss if I didn't ask you, where is your research headed from here?
Well, I'm certainly looking at this cyclic cosmology. I am also looking right now at this, what's called the flavor problem of, you know, relating the quarks to the leptons. And I'm, of course, looking forward to the data from the LHC in 2008 and from the Planck surveyor. So... So, it's very exciting, yeah.
And as we've discussed, there's plenty left to be found out.
Right, 95% of the universe is not understood. Yes.
No worries about being laid off.
No, I have tenure. I have tenure.
You have tenure, so...
So I can't be laid off. But,
there you go.
And I have no plan to retire.
Excellent.
Since I'm enjoying it so much.
Well, Paul, it's been a very stimulating hour. And I want to really thank you for taking the time, particularly on the holiday today, to come in and share your really remarkable ideas with our Radio In Vivo listening audience.
Well, thanks for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Very good. And thank you for your patience with my limited knowledge and understanding of your field.
No, you ask good questions.
I'm glad you thought so. Well, we have got some fantastic guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, RadioInVivo.net, for that lineup, which is updated regularly as we book new appearances. So we hope you will join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carborough and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we ask that you please make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. Thanks a lot. See you next time.